Good morning.
That's great.
It's 9 a.m. This is panel number 5003, Bombastic Brazen Blockchain. And today, we're going to learn about blockchain, of course, Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. But what I'm particularly interested in is the whatever. All of the things that blockchain will make us or allow us to do differently as we go forward into the future. Today's panel includes Martha Clark Goss. And Martha is a financial analyst and corporate board member. We also, at that end of development, have Jenny Fielding, who is a managing director at Techstars. Our other two panelists are more on the analyst end of interest in blockchain, and that's Jerry Mikulski, and he's a tech analyst for several years, and he's kind of a unique guy because he publishes his own brain, and he's going to talk to you a little bit about that because it's something he is excited about doing. And then our fourth person, who will get here just a little bit late, her name is
Charlie Oliver.
Charlie Oliver, and she's actually a CEO type person, somebody who actually utilizes blockchain and commerce. And we'll hope to meet her within the next few minutes. I'm going to spend the 2 minutes allotted to me to tell you how I became interested in blockchain, and I think that will perhaps set up some questions that the panel can address. I am in the shoe business, mobility, pedestrian shops, and very interested in photovoltaics since junior high school, and served on the city council here for 2 years when I had the pleasure of developing Boulder's solar rebate program. Because of my interest in that, I'm very aware of renewable energy credits. So when energy is created without carbon, for 1,000 kilowatt hours, a REC, or a renewable energy credit, is issued. And they are thought to be something that will encourage decarbonization, more and more distributed generation. But how do you use them? They're mostly used in portfolios, so a company like Xcel can say, we get some of our energy from water, from hydro, we get some of our energy from wind. Solar, we buy your RECs off your roof. Well, there are other things that could be done with RECs because of blockchain. So as an example, when you go to the Whole Foods store, it is possible with blockchain that there could be a photograph of a turbine in Boulder Creek that's generating electricity. We have seven of them. One is 100 years old. So if Whole Foods would bid on that using blockchain to audit the attributes, the creation of the REC, its retirement, you could actually credibly say within the EPA system, this store is powered by that turbine. That's very exciting. So that's the other. So when we talk about blockchain, of course we're talking about cryptocurrencies, but we're talking about a lot of other things that are going to change the way we live our lives. And there's some questions that are presented. Will it create more jobs or will jobs go away? Is this equivalent of a robot in your wallet? Is it what will blockchain make different in our lives as individuals beyond cryptocurrencies? And that's my 2 minutes. So what we're going to start with is about 5 minutes from each of our panelists, and then they will have an opportunity to address anything each has said. And then we're going to spend the rest of our time addressing questions that you have. So I think we should just start at the far left, please.
Hey, I'm Jenny Fielding. As was mentioned, I'm at Techstars. We're a venture capital fund that's actually based here in Boulder, which is pretty cool, so I get to come here a bit. My interest in blockchain actually started a long time ago. I started a company in 2006 called Switch Mobile, and we were actually automating what calling cards were doing. And I started thinking about not blockchain technology, but kind of distributed systems. And through that evolution, through understanding more about automation and AI and NLP, I started thinking about, do we need centralized systems or do we need distributed systems? And so with that, started looking into some use cases, but like I ran that company, sold that company in 2010. Then there was kind of a long stretch of maybe like 3 years when I started getting interested in cryptocurrency, but more specifically in blockchain. And the way that I kind of came to it was actually not just understanding the technology, but I was working on some projects around Internet of Things. And so if you think of IoT and this idea of centralized information in the cloud, all of a sudden people were starting to talk about edge computing and pushing everything down to the nodes. And so I invested in a few companies who were doing wireless mesh networking, that was doing middleware around IoT, and the whole thing was everything does not need to be centralized into a cloud, but can be localized at the network level. So that was really how I started getting into it and ended up really more in the blockchain space. I've invested in three verticals, IoT, healthcare, and I guess you'd call it fintech, into various companies. So we can kind of talk about those later, but it's a little bit about me.
Thank you.
So I got involved because my son, who is a tax accountant, has had a client for at least 4 years now who is one of the major Bitcoin dealers or Bitcoin, whatever you call them, Bitcoin whatevers. So it was something when he first mentioned it to me, I knew absolutely nothing about it. And I had him explain it to me. I can't say I understood it the first or second or third time he explained it, but I'm starting to get a better sense of it. But it's also become something that, because I serve on a number of corporate boards, one of which is a mutual fund company, i.e. a financial services company, and one of which is a public utility, there's lots of discussion, as you mentioned, about application of blockchain to lots of other applications other than Bitcoin, which is what most people conflate, or at least I think they conflate Bitcoin and blockchain and think they're the same thing or they're somehow related. And they are in the sense that blockchain is the distributed ledger system, or if you want to call it an accounting system, for the Bitcoin. But it also has lots of other very interesting applications, healthcare being one of them. In fact, I was sitting in the cafeteria this morning with somebody who is from France, and somehow we ended up talking, and he wanted to know what I was speaking about this morning. And so we talked about blockchain. And he asked me, what are some of the applications? And I said, well, one of them is healthcare. At least in this country, we all have lots of bits of information about our healthcare. And particularly when you get to be my age, you've had operations and different illnesses and so forth. And every time you walk into a doctor's office, they give you a piece of paper, and you have to recall everything you've ever had. So that's really cumbersome. Something like the blockchain would give you an opportunity to record that information in one place. People in this country have been resistant. We do have HIPAA regulations that do protect the privacy of your health information. But I think people are still very concerned about it. Blockchain would provide an opportunity to record that information in one place with proper permission. Your doctor or other healthcare provider could access the information and still retain the privacy. And you would have control of the information because you could get into it. Again, I don't know about you, but I don't remember every illness I've had for the last 69 years. So that's a good example of an application. Another one, I know people have started to talk about the security of home titles. And now that theoretically all of your information is available on the internet, all the information about your home title is on the internet, supposedly somebody could go in and steal that information and assign your house ownership to themselves, borrow against it, and eventually, bankrupt you as far as the value of your house. Blockchain is another opportunity for securing that information and making certain that there's not access to it to anybody without proper permission. So to me, there's just some very interesting applications. There are a lot of applications in the financial services business that's the one that I've spent the most time trying to get my hands around again because of my financial services companies. So I feel like I know about this much about this topic, but I'm finding that there is so much disinformation out there that it's really useful to talk about it. And I brought along my book, Blockchain for Dummies. I recommend it if you want to get a basic primer on blockchain.
Charlie, we're just doing a quick go-around, like our five-minute intro, so
sure.
I'll go and buy you a little bit more time. And then yesterday I was on two accidental mantles. We had a couple no-shows, and so I'm really happy to be here. This is not a mantle. This is a regular panel with good diversity. So I'm very, very pleased to be here. I was a tech industry trends analyst for almost a dozen years. Not a Wall Street analyst. I can't tell you what next quarter's earnings are going to be, and I really don't care. But a trends analyst, like AI, is AI going to kill us or save us? When I started in that job in about 1987, I was a neural networks analyst. And neural networks were an old but new form of artificial intelligence or machine learning or whatever you want to call it. And the thing that's happening right now, where we talk about all this new technology that's eating the world, is this neural networks thing in a new life. We now have enough computing power to do things. So pretty interesting. In the dozen odd years that I was in that role, I was working for a woman named Esther Dyson for the latter half of that in New York. So I wrote her newsletter, and we had a big annual conference. And one of the 4,000 odd startups that pitched me during that era had this little piece of software called The Brain. It's a mind map. It's just a mind mapping tool. If you want to take a look at it, the company is at thebrain.com. And then my brain is at jerrysbrain.com. No apostrophe, no space, just jerrysbrain.com. I've been publishing my brain openly. So I keep a memory map. And remember, when I was a tech analyst, it was important for me to remember who competes with whom, what categories are there, who funded whom, who did PR for which company, who are the principals who started the company, what are their products, all that stuff. All that stuff is in my brain. And then you'll also find cocktail recipes, breeds of dog, and what happened during the first 100 years of the 100 years. Wow, that was a really good Freudian slip. What happened during the first 100 days of the Trump administration?
Wow, it feels
boy, did that go somewhere, didn't it? Man, calling Freud.
Exactly.
Calling Freud. So anyway, so we're here to talk about this blockchain thing. And I think one of the easiest ways to think about blockchain is it's exactly like vibranium. All right, it's going to solve everything. Have you guys seen Black Panther?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So vibranium makes everything faster, better, stronger. It's going to solve all the world's problems. It's basically a panacea. At least that's the way blockchain is being pitched, right? And it's kind of hard to understand. Nobody particularly understands it. So we're at this moment where, oh my gosh, everything should be blockchain. And guess what? Blockchain revs every 10 minutes. Blockchain is a slow way to build a distributed open ledger that is trustworthy because you assume everybody's trying to screw you. You can assume that every machine on the network might be fraudulent, and yet through cryptography, through difficult calculations, lots of different people are donating their own computer time, doing the same sets of calculations and comparing them, and then you go, okay, good. This is a legitimate block of what just happened, of all the things that were submitted to through the blockchain. Like, I might buy a comic book using Bitcoin. That would end up on the blockchain as a transaction. And then we add that to the block, say that's the block, and then we tie that to the chain of previous blocks, and hence blockchain, except it's incredibly energy consumptive. Like, I was in Iceland a couple years ago, got a tour of a data center right near the Keflavik Airport that used to be a NATO base, so somebody had bought a building. They'd knocked out a wall, because one of the really cute things about Iceland is there's always a cold wind blowing over Iceland. It's otherwise very habitable. It's a lovely place. It has more fresh water than anybody and natural energy because of all the volcanic stuff. But they knocked out a wall because they'd put air filters on the whole wall, and this whole thing was racks and racks and racks of servers, 80% of which were doing Bitcoin mining 3 years ago. So the amount of energy being spent in the world right now for Bitcoin mining is more than the budget for energy for small countries on Earth. So this is not an efficient, ecological, green kind of thing going on. And there's lots of people doing workarounds and trying to figure out what else to do. Blockchain is also a blunt instrument. It's not a database. You have to run a database somewhere else, then you can drop something on the blockchain. It's also not a real-time anything. And the moment I see articles talking about we're going to do real-time something on the blockchain, I'm like, what have you been smoking? Like you have to do lots of workarounds to make anything real-time-like. And the number of transactions per second that the traditional blockchain can hold is 7, right? Any decent transaction processing system at Visa or wherever is doing thousands. So we have really weird expectations around this technology, which has been built up much like pen computing was built up before smartphones took over the world. I mean, pen computing was really, really hot. The Segway, remember the Segway? And it wasn't going to solve everything. It wasn't, you know, you weren't going to add Segway to your coffee in the morning. But there have been all these sort of panacea technologies. Now, I'm a huge fan of distributed open ledgers. I love the idea of taking a lot of control away from large institutions, some of which are not that trustworthy, and figuring out how we can all do it together. And there are many alternate models for how to do a blockchain. There are competitors to blockchain, one called Chia, one called Holochain. There's a bucket of these, I can tell you, because I keep them in my brain. Right, I track them all, and I keep them logged here. And you can go look at jerrysbrain.com and see alternatives to blockchain. That's the name of the thought. Each node is called a thought. Just go there. So people talk about blockchain being trustless. It's not trustless. You're trusting the algorithms. Mm-hmm. There are ways in which blockchain systems are corruptible. There's sort of a, if you owned more than 50% of the servers in a blockchain network, you could, in principle, fake a block, say that's the block, and then put a fake block into the blockchain and really screw things up for everybody. Mm-hmm. That's probably not happening, but that's one of the different kinds of attacks that might happen. But I think what they mean is by trustless, which is odd to me because trust is my big word for the last 10 years, what they really mean is everybody using blockchain might be trying to defraud you, and the thing will probably still survive and be reasonable and irrefutable, right? That's interesting. That's a really interesting capacity. But it's not Vibronium, I'm afraid. And I'll end with the thing that that sort of brought me to where I am today on my own journey is realizing that I couldn't stand the word consumer back when I was a tech analyst. And of the 4,000 little companies that came through, probably a third were doing B2C, business to consumer, and they were consumer this, consumer that, and I was like, every time they said it, I was itching and bouncing in my chair, and I was like, why do I hate this word? I paid attention to the word for 20 years. It gifted me the idea that we've consumerized every sector of human activity, not just consumer goods. But remember, we used to call it culture, and we used to memorize poems and do plays together and learn instruments? Now it's Nintendo or Netflix. I mean, there's still people learning instruments, thank God. But we replaced culture. We replaced our electoral system, how we've, you know, voting has become a consumer exercise. We think of consumers of healthcare, consumers of education. And when you're a consumer, your only job is to choose between the things on offer and buy a lot of stuff. Because if you stop buying, the economy melts, and then we're all doomed. This is a really stupid system, right? And if you read The Great Transformation by Carl Polanyi, who talks about the shift into the industrial economy, he describes how we used to live together. And there's lots of alternative ways. We've just forgotten them all. And so now we have, it's either capitalism and liberal democracy or socialism or communism, and look how horrible they were. You know, there is no alternative. TINA is a phrase, and it's an ignorant phrase. So I think blockchain lies under a whole series of revolutions that are going on about whether we trust each other, how we do, whether we need centralized institutions to sort of control everything, or whether we can take back power ourselves, the decentralization of control and governance, which I love. And I'm looking forward to the rest of the panel.
Great, thank you.
Now we'll hear from Charlie.
Good morning. And my apologies for being tardy. I apologize. Thank you for having me. Happy Friday, everyone. We made it. So thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be on this panel and the opportunity to speak with brilliant people about a topic that is as sort of controversial and exciting as this one is always an honor, a privilege, actually. So my name is Charlie Oliver, and I'm the founder of Served Fresh Media, which is a digital media strategy agency in New York City that I founded about, 8 years ago. And we primarily help companies to figure out what they want to say, how they want to say it, and the technologies that they need to use or need to use in order to do that. So we work with innovation teams. I talk to them a lot about how to organically implement technologies. And it's very rewarding because I get to sort of synthesize a lot of the noise for companies and to help them to focus on really engaging their employees and their potential customers and current customers. Having said that, back in January of 2017, I launched Tech 2025, which is a subsidiary of Surfresh Media, and that was specifically for having the same types of conversations about technologies, but with the general public, because I began to see in the faces of these C-suite executives, right, who are running these companies, that when you mention blockchain and you mention AI and you talk about these technologies, absolute terror in their faces, right? And I mean, a fear that I had not seen really ever before. And they were being vocal about the fear, which you're not used to seeing as well. And so my thought was, well, if you're scared to death and you're sort of really unsure about the future, and to the point where you're voicing it in ways that I've never heard before, what is everyone else thinking? How are you talking to everyone else in your organization? Who's talking to the secretary? Who's talking to the supervisor who has to talk to his team about, or her team about this stuff? So that's what we do. And this is a perfect example of why I think Tech 2025 and organizations like that, there are others, is important. Because we're at a time right now when we have so many different emerging technologies erupting at the same time. And it makes predicting anything almost impossible. It'd be different if we were just talking about blockchain or just AI or just 3D printing, but it's all of these things culminating at once all together. And so it's a big sort of soup. So with blockchain, I came into, so what we do basically with Tech 2025 is we get people, everyone together to talk about these things in what we call think tanks. So in 2016, with regards to blockchain, I was introduced to blockchain because early 2016, I began reading about how the global banks were sort of coming together in consortiums to figure out blockchain and to form partnerships to test it and to, you know, and when I see big banks, big global banks partnering and moving together to try to figure something out, that's my red flag, right? I mean, it's cute when the entrepreneurs are trying to figure stuff out, and I am one, so I respect that. But when the big banks start coming together, okay, from what I mean, it's forming these big consortiums, there's something going on here. So that's when I first took notice. And I went to a conference called the Blockchain Blah 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 Conference. And it was for hedge fund managers, lawyers. It was primarily financial. And that's probably the earliest sort of ideas around blockchain that are sort of, I say substantive only because that's where a lot of the funding is going right now, right? Fintech. And I got to tell you, this was a very eye-opening thing for me. And this is what sort of confirms for me the need for something like a Tech 2025 and these types of panels, right, discussions. I went to this conference, which was funded by PCW, right? And, you know, so it was a nice conference. And I'm surrounded by lawyers. I'm surrounded by hedge fund managers, you know, finance people. And nobody knows what the hell blockchain is. This is 2016. And we were very honest in saying that. But there were presentations, you know, and they were pretty interesting. And this one person got up and spoke, and it was the CMO of one of the top three e-commerce companies online. So that should narrow it down for you. And he gave a presentation that was actually the most popular one of the whole day. And I always look for those, right, the ones that resonate with us emotionally, that makes, because, you know, no one knew what blockchain was, and we were all just kind of sitting there like this, you know. And he got up and gave this presentation, and at one point in the presentation, everyone in the room began clapping and cheering. And I mean, these are finance people, right? These are like investment bankers and stuff. So that moment was when the gentleman put a screen up on his presentation, and it was of a pig on a farm. And this huge blade comes out, and he's talking about the blade. And on the blade, it says blockchain, right? And then the pig is the banks and the middlemen, right? And then the blade starts hacking away at the pig. And it's an animation, mind you. It's not anything too good. So there's blood splurting everywhere, but
I'm
it's an animation.
It was tasteful.
Yeah, it was tasteful. It was cute. But it was the thing that made this room full of finance people who are actually the middlemen, right, begin to start cheering and laughing. And that was, and so there's something about that. Because, again, these aren't the people, these are the people who would be affected by this. So I took away from that, like, okay, first of all, wow, this is probably something that's really going to disrupt this, and we're probably really ready for it. But I also took away the fact that when I talked to people in that room that day, no one knew what it was. No one still understood, everyone was still sort of like trying to figure it out. So fast forward, you know, to Tech 2025, last year, I decided that when I introduced blockchain to the community. And when I say the community, I mean we have everyone in there from, you know, entrepreneurs, students, investment bankers, we have technologists, we have retirees. When I introduce this topic, it has to be done in a way where we can all have a conversation about this that helps us to figure out what it is, not just in terms of the technology, but also philosophically, socially, emotionally. I think of blockchain as a community more than I do a technology. And I would suggest that you do that if you don't understand it. Don't think about it as a technology. That's an automatic block. It's really not. It's a community. And I am in New York City, and I'm a part of so many blockchain communities in New York City, and they are sprouting up. There's literally now more blockchain communities and events in New York City than any other type of technology, even AI. Okay, and I do events. I've been doing events for clients. That's part of what we do for like 10 years now around technologies. So when I decided to introduce this to the community, I said, how am I going to do this? You know, how am I going to do this in a way that makes sense to you guys? And I did it by, you know, we did a blockchain journalism event in December. And the reactions that we got from the community about this technology that we introduced to them, and this technology was created, well, the company, which is Civil Blockchain, was founded or co-founded by Daniel Seberg, who founded Google News Labs. Okay, so he spent the last like 10 years or so talking about Google News Labs, traveling the world. So he's a pretty smart guy. And I reached out to him and his startup, and I said, you guys have this blockchain that's supposed to, quote unquote, give people the power to tell their own news stories, right, within their communities, because we all know that the local news communities are sort of dwindling away. And I said, why don't you come in and talk to our community about it? I think this is what I want to use to introduce blockchain to our community in a substantive way. And he came, and I got to tell you something. I happen to know for a fact that it was one of the most challenging things that he had to do with regards to talking about this, because it's one thing to talk to other technologists and to VCs about this stuff. But I said to him, really, who cares? I mean, you know, when you come in here, you've got to be able to talk to them about how it's going to affect them. So anyway, by the end of the event, he did the presentation. I got to tell you, everyone in that room, and there were some journalists in there because we attracted a lot of journalists because of the topic, but we attracted ordinary people who were curious. By the end of the event, people were just sort of like, and they were vocal about it. Why should I care? I don't know about this. What is it? What does it mean? And I will say this. When we began to have discussions about it, one of the things that we did was we made them break into groups and talk about it. No one really understood still, even after his presentation, what are you offering me? Like, and my question to you, and my question to you and you and myself and to everyone is, the first thing that he said was, we are going to get rid of the middleman, right? And so in Tech 2025, we talk about the middleman a lot because we all have fantasies of getting rid of the middleman. And if blockchain is going to get rid of the middleman, what does that mean to you? First of all, who really is the middleman? We're talking about advertisers, right? That's definitely one of them. And then banks. But the middleman is, we are addicted to the middleman right now. So what does that mean to get? That's not going to be an easy process at all. And when you think about the idea of blockchain coming along, that it's supposed to be called a trustless system. I don't believe that myself. I'm with you on that. We have to give up something to get the promise of what this technology is supposed to offer. The question is, what are we going to have to give up? Because the middleman is going to fight to keep you. Okay, the middleman, whether it's the advertisers or the banks or whatever, there is going to need to be a struggle of some kind that I think we do need to discuss, because it's not going to be, you know, all easy and everything. People in my community, in the Tech 2025 community, appreciated that discussion. And then after that, we talked about the legislation around it. We had an event about legislation around blockchain, which is really important. Assemblyman Bannell in New York City put forth bills to introduce blockchain legislation. And we brought the community in, meaning we brought the developers of blockchain in and some, you know, finance people, hedge fund people, and we brought the politician in to talk about it. He doesn't know anything about blockchain either. He's learning too. We're all learning. And that day, we all learned just how much we don't know, even in a room full of the experts. So what I would suggest, it's very fascinating because it's true. The more you learn, the more you realize, I don't know what's going on. So let me just sum up by saying, one of the most important things that I've learned about this is that while there is a lot of potential here, and it can go any way in a number of different directions, we are very early, which is a fact. We are so early, and there are so many problems with regards to understanding what it is and developing it, that there's opportunity there for anyone if you, number one, want to participate in this. If you feel like you have great ideas, I mean, now is the time to jump in, because I'm telling you, especially in the big cities, in New York City or whatever, it takes nothing to start a community and to just begin to talk about it. If five of you right now got together and said, let's try to figure this stuff out, let's figure out, and you called any of us or any expert, so-called expert or someone in blockchain, they would talk to you. Everyone is talking about this. So I would say be bold about wanting to learn about this and reaching out to the people who are making the biggest claims even or doing the most interesting things. You can literally reach out to them right now and they will talk to you about it because they want to. So begin to form micro communities, because what I'm finding is that in these micro communities, there are a lot of interesting and compelling conversations and solutions that are happening. And we're not hearing all of them, but we should. Right. So, I mean, I'll end on this. If you're interested in learning more about blockchain and its implications, think about it as a community, which it is. And it's a difficult community, too, because there's a lot of things that are going on that we have not talked about. But there's a lot of darkness there. Like anything else, you know, when you start communities and there's a lot of excitement and there's a lot of money or potential, there's some negative things, too. So anyway, Start talking about it amongst yourselves and reach out to me. And I don't want to put you out there, but anyone else that you feel like you want to reach out to, just be bold about it. Okay, that's.
Thank you, Charlie. So I'm going to share a little bit of information with you, and then each of the panelists are going to respond as they feel appropriate to what they've heard. In this CWA session, we will utilize both CWA app, which you may have on your phone, and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. And there are folks here, if you just raise your hand, if you don't have the app and you want to submit a question, they'll bring you an index card. And then other information is there's an order sheet on your chair. If you could take a look at it, make any appropriate notations, and then pass it to the aisles. We're not doing that. They're waving me off. I guess we're not doing that.
To the middle.
Excuse me. Not okay. To the ends. To the middle.
Phew.
Thank you. I thought we had a problem. That's not a big problem. And then lastly, if any of you have already been bold and had your blockchain IPO, there is a crowdfunding campaign to fund CWA, and it has a $70,000 goal. It's about a quarter of the way there. So if your broker's called you this morning and told you you're wealthy, think of us. And with that, as you deal with the forms and write down any questions you may have, we're going to let the panelists respond to each other. Thank you very much. Do you folks want to speak to what each other have said?
I think we can pick up on a couple threads. Do you want to go ahead? I'll pick up a little bit on the idea of middlemen that Charlie was talking about. And in some industries, middlemen are really easy to bypass, and they're just sort of left in the dust going, wait, I used to have a business, think retail, mm-hmm. Right? Amazon is knocking off retail, and if you have a store, you go to your local mall, the anchor store is probably gone, and some of the other key stores are going away. Ironically, Amazon is now doing bookstores, physical bookstores. But what's left is like a P.F. Chang and a Pilates parlor, right? And there's your mall and there's your stores. So those were all middlemen, and retail is 100% markup on what you bought it at wholesale. So that's really interesting, because if you're the manufacturer, you're like, well, hey, maybe I get higher margins by going directly through this other platform that takes less. Other middlemen, much harder to budge. Who has bought or sold a home in the last 5 years? Yeah. Love the paperwork, right? There's been a threat to replace brokers and realtors and ever since the intertubes first started. And that still hasn't apparently happened. The paperwork is sort of a nightmare, and it involves lots of different people looking up titles, doing credit searches. It involves inspections and God knows what, a whole bunch of aspects of which are not highly motivated to be automated out of existence. So blockchain entrants coming into that market have a lot of work to do, but there's a huge opportunity there, right? Just as there's a big opportunity in the construction trades to do something very different because they've been very resistant to change of any kind, and they've done a very good job defending their markets. So I think the middleman question is a really interesting thing. It's a very good business opportunity for in lots of ways, but it's pretty different sector by sector.
I guess I would just say from a venture capital point of view, in the last, say, few years, there's been this kind of movement to just add blockchain to everything. That's one of the things you kind of have to look out for, and I think some of you made the points of, like, is it really more efficient? I mean, there's security issues, there's latency issues, and so, you know, I think sometimes these things get conflated. It's kind of the new buzzword, but is that actually the right technology for that product at the right time? So it's just something to think about.
One of our corporate clients that's through Surfresh Media actually has a very measured, because I always am thinking about obviously my clients, right? The companies who are investing in these technologies or developing them. And we have a client that is a 30-year-old software development company. They automate software for the enterprise, basically. And a few months ago, we do sort of events for them where we engage their customers in discussions about technologies and everything. And I suggested back in September, we pitched the idea of doing a blockchain event. Nothing big, nothing, you know, but just a discussion about it. Let's talk about it. And they weren't ready at the time, but a couple months ago, back in, I think it was February, I suggested it again. And the CEO of the company was in Japan at the time and found out that we pitched this idea, you know, just doing a small event, 100 or so people, and he said, "We're not touching blockchain. It's not a. We don't." And I said, "Look, it's just a discussion. It's just an event." Nope. And I said, "But your enterprise clients are talking about this." And he says, "I don't care. I don't want to talk. This is not something we're ready for yet." And I found that to be really interesting because I'm hearing. Usually, it's the opposite. It's like, okay, let's blockchain. You know, it's almost like a fad, right? It sounds like it. But I really respected the fact that this company said, you know what, we don't care. It doesn't make sense for us. It's not something, even though our customers are talking about it, talking about something and the implementation of it in a smart way that's going to sort of push a company's goal forward, their digital transformation goal forward, is two completely different things. And if you want to know the truth of the matter, there aren't really a lot of companies that are understanding how to do that or that are doing that. They're experimenting, and there's a lot of money sort of being thrown at this, and some more than others, depending on the industry. But, you know, real use case scenarios of how to do this in a way that companies do it, looking at a 5-year-out plan, it's just not there yet. The blockchainification of everything, I'm not for that.
I wouldn't disagree with that, but I also, again, as a board member, and we've had a lot of discussions in panels or forums of directors. You don't want to be on the bleeding edge, but you want to be a fast follower. And in order to be a fast follower, you've got to have some knowledge of what's going on. So I think as board members, and I think you'll find this in many, many companies, we do talk about it at, you know, not every meeting and not, you know, not for more, maybe more than 15 or 20 minutes. But I think it's imperative. It's imperative for anybody in business, but it's particularly imperative for senior managements and board members to have some concept of what this is, what's going on with it, could it disintermediate your business, and what do you do to stay ahead of the game so that you don't get, you know, disintermediated or pushed out of your business. It's one of the reasons that the big financial institutions you were talking about, they're really hot on it. The big financial institutions are highly threatened by this because they are the ultimate intermediators. And so they don't want to be disintermediated out of their businesses. So they're talking about how can they use this technology to be ahead of somebody else who might try to come in, take over their payments processing, or any of their other intermediation businesses.
Thank you. So a lot of the questions have to do with defining blockchain, because it is a complicated and new concept. I think we've gotten some of that in the context of the opening remarks that we've had this morning. Is there a feeling in the room that you still don't understand the general mechanics of blockchain? If there is, could you please raise your hand, because I think that's a great place to start.
I love it.
I think that's enough. Thank you very much.
I have a diagram.
I actually was really excited. I just found this about 3 or 4 weeks ago in one of my corporate board magazines. And it's an I guess maybe I could get a copy made or leave it with somebody for CWA to pass out if people are interested, because it goes through what's and Jerry's explanation. Again, in one of the earlier panels, somebody brought up blockchain. You know, what is blockchain? Why is it called a blockchain? And your explanation was absolutely perfect. It's, you know, a block of data, and then it's connected to other blocks of data. So that's why it's called a blockchain. But this is a great diagram that talks about the fact that somebody has a transaction. They take it to a peer network of computers who verify the transaction, and then they put it into a block, and then they put the transactions together, and they make the blockchain. So I would be happy to somehow or other get this, I don't know if we can do that, but get it copied, and if people want copies of it, because it's a really good explanation.
We can probably take a photo of it and then
sure.
It down.
Oh, that's okay, great. That's great. See, you're much more technologically proficient than I am.
I'd like to add the idea that if you change a block, it changes the block's relationship to the other blocks. So consequently, you can't easily forge a block or manipulate the calculations in a block without throwing all of the other blocks out of sequence in the algorithm. So I think when people talk about the safety of the blockchain, that's really what they're addressing. Is that right?
Yeah. And also,
go ahead.
Oh, go for it.
So this is great, because this is a constant in the communities, and even in the communities that are very much about blockchain, the constant discussion is, what is it? What is it? That is not going to go away. And that's a good thing, because I have a feeling the definition is going to change, and it should, if it's a technology that's evolving, right? So I did a podcast. We have a podcast at Tech 2025 that I was co-hosting in the first season with Ed McGuire, who's an analyst at CLA, and now he is a managing partner at Momenta Partners. Very smart man. And we did a blockchain episode. And in this episode, we decided we were going to talk about blockchain, and it was going to be called, What is Blockchain? I mean, it was a very ambitious episode. And I did it. It was three of us, myself, Ed, and our media coordinator, one of our bloggers, actually. She's a young woman, she's about 25 years old, and she's a product manager. And we all were assigned the task of going to learn about blockchain and coming back and talking about it to our audience. And we came back and sat there and looked like we had been hit by a truck. I mean, we basically just went online and did our research and came back, and all three of us were just kind of like, what the hell? And we didn't have a better definition of it than we did before. It was just more stuff, more crap, more, you know. So we went back and we did the episode again, and we did it from the perspective of, okay, let's just look at one particular example of it, and that's fine. But in my research, what I learned was that there are a lot of places online that are addressing this very problem, the problem of how to talk about blockchain, how to learn about it, and how to keep up on it in a way that's substantive. One of the things that I found is that there are a lot of MOOCs, right, online courses. Coursera and edX have amazing blockchain 101 courses. These are free courses that you can take online at your leisure. There are little communities around them. I implore you to consider doing that, because the people who are teaching them are great. I think they're backed by institutions. I forget which ones. But if you want to just really get the basics, definitely do those online free courses. That's number one. And then number two, there are, now I don't know about, you know, meetups here in this town, I mean, but there are a lot of online groups and on Facebook especially that talk about this very thing, and it's a constant discussion of what is it. You'll hear it if you go into these groups. Mm-hmm. My third suggestion is that you yourself begin to talk about it, because it really is odd. It's one of these things where you keep hearing about it and you still don't understand it, but if you begin to try to define it yourself, and allow yourself to feel that awkwardness of what the hell am I talking about? Like, you know, because you do feel that. I mean, every time when you talk about it, it's like, okay, I know that it's a system of this and that. Get used to talking about it. You know what I mean? And that's why it's important to form little groups to talk about it, you know?
I'll try to take us a little bit deeper. I gave my 2-minute version a little while ago, and actually the problem is that I could give my 2-hour version, and we would walk away not fully understanding what this thing is. I did not mention Bitcoin or any of the other aspects to it, or any of the other 2,000 coins that are out there, 70-80% of which are probably fraudulent, right? There are other platforms that I'll try to explain in a little bit. One thing you could do is go to the App Store or to the Android Play Store or whatever. This is a Bitcoin wallet. There are multiple wallets out there, and you could spend, you know, 10 of your hard-earned dollars to buy a fractional little itty-bitty piece of a Bitcoin and then see what's available to do it. It's actually quite easy to do. And an electronic wallet on your phone will actually let you look around and go, well, what could I spend this on, et cetera, et cetera. So I told you that when I started as a tech analyst, I was a neural networks analyst. I used to have to explain neural networks. And I will tell you that to this day, far easier to explain how deep learning and neural networks work. And that's complicated stuff. I'm happy to go there rather than the morass that is sort of blockchain plus Bitcoin plus all these other things. But I will mention that once you begin to understand sort of the existence of this new platform that's distributed, that does stuff, and then you understand that there are currencies that are coming out on top of it to both pay for the labor of doing the work of processing these calculations, right? Their people are mining, they're earning the coin, which they then can spend in the infrastructure. On top of all this, some of these platforms allow for smart contracts and things like digital autonomous organizations or DAOs and crazy stuff. So, for example, a smart contract means programmatically I could actually buy some services. So, for example, remember in Minority Report, Ethan is walking through the mall and like either through face recognition or iris recognition or his Bluetooth, all the billboards are recognizing him and saying, hey, Mr. Hawk, would you like to buy our jeans? Well, that scenario is perfectly doable today through normal technology. We have good face recognition. We have all this other kind of stuff. But it's also possible to imagine a completely autonomous billboard that is its own little corporation with no humans involved, where it can source electricity for itself and negotiate rates, where it can say, oh, I've just identified Ethan. I'm going to ping a server and say, I've got the profile for this person. What's the best ad to show Ethan? There would be a service that would do that, where all the different aspects of, oh, I need a repairman. I can tell a part is about to fail and contract for repair services to show up, maybe even a human. But we're heading into a world of that. And so I just layered a whole bunch of other messy stuff on top of this world of distributed open ledgers that open up those possibilities. So we're heading toward that. And it's like complicated on top of complicated, but opens up all kinds of interesting possibilities.
Thank you. Anything further, or can we take a student question? So we really appreciate it if you are a student and you mark your questions, because this is the University of Colorado and we want to make sure that we remember that students are the center of it. So my first student question today is, how could blockchain empower people in countries where their institutions are even more untrustworthy than ours? Do you have any answers for that?
Anybody want to go? So, in lots of countries, you can't tell land title. You don't know where anything came from. All kinds of things. One of the benefits of being behind is that you can leapfrog, right? So in Kenya, anybody heard of M-Pesa?
Yeah.
So some 70% of transactions in Kenya happen through M-Pesa. People pay their payroll through M-Pesa. M-Pesa is a mobile payment system that doesn't need a smartphone. It worked originally through texting. You just sort of picked things, and it was very simple menus. But you know, before M-Pesa, if you wanted to send the money you had earned to your mom in your home village, you had to take a big bag of shillings, hand it to a cab driver, pay him a lot of money to go to your village, and hope that he didn't like stop and deposit it in his own account, blah, 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 blah. The interim technology was to buy a phone card, read the number of the phone card to the, a person in your mom's village who was then adding those numbers to your mom's phone, and that was money transfer before M-Pesa. That was a form of remittances, right? And now all of a sudden, they have just leapfrogged forward. We look damn primitive in relation to people who are doing mobile payments all the time and take it completely for granted. So I think there's big opportunities to leapfrog when you don't have much infrastructure, and deep-seated corruption or completely untrustworthy records are a very big motivator to jump to some risky new solution. So more than us, I think they'll be highly motivated to replace and pioneer some different sorts of systems. Jenny probably has some good, you know, she's probably heard 100 pitches of companies that are doing blockchain for development around insurance, around title registries, around health registries or health IDs or whatever else it is. I think that's all really interesting stuff. A tiny historic note about the telephone and sort of leapfrogging. The telephone did not catch on in England very quickly at all. It took a really much longer than in the U.S. Why? Well, number one, they have a fantastic postal system that was a spectacle in its time. People used to tour the post office. They used to sit outside the post office and promenade while the carriages came in and left to send out. It was a miracle of modern technology. You could post a letter anywhere in the British Isles, and it would get there, get to its destination the next day. Also, gentlemen don't use a telephone. The culture wasn't so good, so adaptable to telephones. In the U.S., we had long distances. In fact, rural telephony grows up faster than urban because you can use the barbed wire fences as a signal carrier, and you can create rural telephony with party lines going all the way out to the last farm. So rural phone systems grew up really easily, really quickly. All kinds of weird technological sort of leaps happen, and blockchain plus all this other stuff on top offers worldwide opportunities to do so.
So most of these questions I understand because I'm really interested in this subject, but here's one I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. And it's in very small font.
Yes, and it's very small. So do the rise of quantum computers pose a threat to cryptocurrency, cryptography of blockchain, to the power in bits versus prime numbers? Does anybody know
no
what
idea.
That means?
Yes.
No idea about that.
Like, okay. Can I take a swing at that?
Yes.
All right.
What he said.
Yes, I'll try to do that.
Are quantum computers going to endanger the cryptography? Yeah. Read it into the mic. That they could.
Yeah. Yes, I'm sorry. I will read it more clearly. Do the rise of quantum computers pose a threat to cryptography of blockchain? To the power in bits versus prime numbers?
So, a couple of leading edge technologies are things like optical computing, quantum computing. In quantum, and if you want to hear a layman's explanation of quantum computing that's quite good, you can watch an interview that Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, did about a month ago that's available on YouTube. He did a very nice job of understanding quantum computing. And basically, atoms have quantum states that are pretty different in nature and are usable in very different ways from the normal way that we flip bits in a computer. Computers are binary. They're a bit is on or off. In a quantum system, you have qubits or quantum bits that have states that vary. They're more than I can explain here. But one of the great virtues of quantum computing is that they can do immense calculations very quickly. They can resolve to solutions differently from traditional computers, which means the cryptographic systems that keep blockchain and other things, cryptocurrencies alive, and cryptography is the art of encrypting, meaning if I send you a letter but I shift all the letters over one so that it looks unreadable, that's one of the simplest ciphers in the world. That's encryption of one kind. We're talking about way more sophisticated cryptography that powers the systems like blockchain. But quantum computers could, in fact, make cracking those numbers much simpler. And also the proof of work that's being done to mine new bitcoins or other things could be done much more efficiently, perhaps, using quantum computing. So if they get effective quantum computers that are working, it could tip this whole thing, and that could be over the next 10 years. So, yes.
Thank you for that very easy to understand explanation.
That's right. There will be a quiz at the end of the session.
Yes. Here's a question that I think is a little easier to understand. How are the servers used to process blockchain transactions determined? If a lot of servers are owned by China and Russia, could they manipulate things?
Shall I take a swing at this?
Yes, okay.
This means I agree with whatever's being said. This means I disagree. So these are the General Assembly hand signs from Occupy. I offer them to you because they change you from being a mere audience to actually being able to react, and we can get the temperature of what's happening, right? Mm-hmm. So the question was, who does the servers? So many years ago, I had a party at my house, and a buddy of mine, Pete Kaminsky, shows up with a little server about this big, which he plugs in on my desk, and he's basically Bitcoin mining. And we all walk around, we're like, ooh, cool, that's kind of nifty. And this is back in the days when Bitcoin is probably $9 worth of Bitcoin or whatever. It's pretty early days. He's since become a little bit more involved in that. And so anybody can offer up server space and start trying to participate in the network. The problem is that it's become an arms race for computing power. And so Bitcoin mining, it turns out that the processors that were invented to create graphics on your screen, that's a pretty hard calculation to do well. GPUs, graphic processor units, became very popular for things like these cryptographic calculations. Now we're creating special purpose chips just for mining Bitcoin. So it's raced way ahead. So you with your home rig are very likely hopeless in this. Until just recently, when the government of China said, oops, we're not going to do this anymore, the majority of Bitcoin mining rigs or servers were in the People's Republic of China, probably with no locks on the doors, in the place in China where they could get the cheapest energy, because these things are big energy sucks. And China, as a policy matter, said, we don't really want to do that so much. But I was like, how does anybody trust a system where the PLA could walk in any day and confiscate all the servers, take the whole thing? I didn't understand that, but I think that's less of a threat now. But yes, there's a huge threat out there. Jenny, what are you saying?
I mean, I would just add that, you know, as we go from hardware to software, hopefully this will be less of an issue, right? So I think we're moving in that direction right now. Bitcoin mining is a huge drain on the ecosystem, and I think, you know, we're coming up with solutions that are going to, I think we're going to get past this quite quickly, so.
Thank you. Mrs. Fielding and Mrs. Oliver voiced their concerns for blockchain being too overly integrated into certain industries and professions. Where do you foresee the most promising applications of blockchain technology?
I don't know, most promising, but I'll give you an example of something that I think is a good use of blockchain as opposed to what we call a throw a blockchain on it. So I have a company, they're actually based in Israel, and their backgrounds were in the shipping industry. And what they noticed was that these things called bills of lading, which are the actual documents that are issued and distributed by all the parties in a shipping transaction, were often fraudulent and or missing. And so if you think about the shipping ecosystem, you have the shippers, you have the banks, you have the forwarders, you have the operators, with so many people that needed to agree on this thing called a bill of lading. And so I think shipping and logistics more broadly is like a really great use case for blockchain, where you can take the human element out, you can add security, and you can really unite these parties that might be around the world that might not necessarily agree, but you actually have a way through the blockchain to verify it. So I think that's an interesting use case. I mean, it's one of many, but it's one that's been on my mind recently.
Healthcare, definitely. Yeah. You know, healthcare, your data in healthcare, it's huge. There's a, I don't want to say a battle for it, but it certainly is one of the most compelling. I mean, and there's a lot of startups. I know Jenny could probably speak to that better. But what's going to happen with your data with regards to, you know, how it's shared or distributed or accessed? I think blockchain technology is probably going to impact that more than any other technology.
Yeah, electronic medical records is a great example. You go from one hospital system, one state to another, and you know, does that record follow, is it based in the hospital, or does it follow you in your person? So I think that's a great example.
I'll just add a bit of a caveat to that, which is a little bit of what I said earlier, that these things vary wildly by which domain you're looking at. Shipping is a really nice example. I love logistics. Way back when, the founder of McLean Trucking basically had a bunch of bright ideas that turned into the containerization of all shipping. So it used to be we had stevedores who had ropes and nets, and everything got packed loose and got packed in holds, and good luck to you. And there was a whole industry of stevedores. There are very few stevedores left. In fact, the container shipping ports had to give them nice fat retirement packages and say, you can't hire anymore, and let them age out, right? So containerization just completely changed. It now costs $3,000 to ship a container of pretty much anything from any port to any other port on Earth. There's a nice book on this called The Box, I think. So I think it's like logistics are really amenable to this. Go into personal healthcare records and then talk about HIPAA and European data privacy laws and all the players that are completely wedged against each other there. I'm surprised there hasn't been a bypass play where somebody said, hey, here's a personal healthcare record. Let's flesh it out. Google had something called Google Health. I signed up immediately. They deprecated it. They got rid of it. So nobody's made the end run that would become the I own my health data, and hospitals have to adapt to that. That's not happening. Same thing when I say home sales and title searches and all that. When a government's interests are involved, it's going to be hard to dislodge them. So I'm watching with curiosity how this plays out in sector after sector, and then in geography after geography, because the politics and the governments are different, and the motivation for change is very different around the world.
Thank you.
Actually, let me make one other comment. I was describing earlier about health records and discussing this with a man from France. He pulled out a card, and I know these are available elsewhere, and I know there are systems in the United States that may cost you $20,000 a year to be a member, where you can have this centralized database of your health insurance or health records. But he pulled out a card that they use in France, and it is, you take it with you to the hospital or to your doctor's office, and they can access all of your health records at any point in time, and it expedites the system. So they do exist, but they aren't based on blockchain. But I think, again, it's a huge opportunity for blockchain, particularly in this country where people are very skittish about, you know, despite HIPAA, are still very skittish about having their healthcare records in one central place where an insurance company or some other institutional player can access them.
You went to a country with a functional healthcare system, meaning not the U.S.
Right.
a question which I think follows that very well is, with the lack of regulation within blockchain and Bitcoin for that matter, would the overall population feel comfortable enough to give up already set up financial institutions for a chain with real understanding of what they were doing?
May I start on that? So who trusts the dollar a lot? Raise your hand if you trust the dollar a lot. Well, we use the dollar every day, right? What happened during the 2008 financial crisis? First, the subprime crisis, and then it cascaded and became a global financial crisis. Basically, we almost melted the economy. We almost melted dollars. It was really hard to rein in from a general meltdown like Three Mile Island or Chernobyl. We had a money Chernobyl. Why? I grew up partly in South America, partly in Argentina. And Argentina has had the worst whipsawing over 50, 100 years. It's a terrible place to try to be stable economically. And I asked myself, what did the average Argentine do, besides being a little more arrogant than the average Latin American, what did the average Argentine do to deserve losing their pension plan, losing everything, because some idiots are manipulating the currency and making stupid contracts and being corrupt? And like, fiat currencies, the currencies that governments issue, are really pretty dangerous, and they're very tightly coupled to each other. And there's an entire financial system, Wall Street, London, wherever, that's busy trying to figure out how to game this thing. And in the subprime crisis, a guy named John Paulson convinced a couple companies to start issuing collateralized debt obligations and credit swaps and all that kind of stuff. And the math was faulty in these instruments. Nobody thought that the market could go down, and the calculations nobody did the analysis of the downside risk. So these were actually broken instruments that everybody agreed to go buy and do. And we, like, there's a nice article in the aftermath that Michael Lewis wrote called It's the Economy Dummkopf in The Atlantic, I think, where he goes to a little pension fund, a teacher's pension fund in northern Germany, little town, which went under because they invented in CDOs and CDSs. And the punchline at the end of that article is, we were doing our analysis, you know, we're not idiots, but those things were all rated AAA, which means no risk, right? So if you trust the dollar system, good luck to you, because this thing happens regularly every decade. The one we saw in 2008 was particularly vicious and almost broke the system. But every 10 years there's a big debt crisis or a big money crisis of some kind. The system is not that stable. So these things that are alternatives are actually very interesting. And anybody who can decouple, I love time banking. Because at least with time banking, you can keep money in your local economy even if there's no jobs. You can volunteer, you can actually make you can keep resources locally, and you can decouple from the fiat currency economy. We need a little bit of buffering from people who are busy creating beta. Beta is volatility, because beta is where you make money. So they want beta. No beta, no exorbitant profits.
Thank you. Jerry's autonomous billboard example seems to touch on the intersection of blockchain and AI. Can you speak more about what you think makes that look like what that looks like as both technologies advance?
I'm happy to elaborate a little more. That's an extremely accurate question. I mean, without AI and this blockchain stuff, that example doesn't come to fruition, because it takes a lot of local intelligence to make those decisions well enough to survive as a little autonomous business. We don't really have time to dive any deeper into machine learning, but these things are getting pretty good. I mean, for example, who's heard of AlphaGo? Raise your hand if you know what AlphaGo is. So Google created a neural network program that learned the game of Go, which is an Asian game that's more difficult than chess. It then played this game of Go against the world's best Go players and beat them, which is interesting. Then, and to train up, because neural networks usually need training, you show them a bunch of data sets. So what they did with AlphaGo is they gave it all the best Go games that have ever been played. And just like chess, every stone put on every place, this goes back a couple thousand years. It's kind of cool. So that's how they trained AlphaGo. Then they invented AlphaGo Plus, which they showed no training sets. They just told it the rules of Go, which are sort of like the rules of checkers, only a little bit better. AlphaGo Plus not only beat the world's best Go player, but began inventing moves that Go scholars are studying. It went way past the capacity of the best Go players. Now, Go is a domain like this, and it's not common sense, and it's not broad artificial intelligence, but we don't really need broad artificial intelligence to start knocking off different types of employment and to start creating billboards that can do their own thing, because that's a really narrow domain. So this is here, and it's happening all over the place. And the question is, are there ethical problems with it? Who is implementing it? What happens to employment? I mean, there's been a future of work panel, and I'm sure this has come up on many other panels. This is going to affect everything.
So with regards to that, I'm so glad you brought that up, we actually are doing an event at Tech 2025 based on that AlphaGo, and it's on based on a movie, which I strongly suggest you see, number one, because it's a great film, and it's, to me, a really great representation of everything that you just said, along with the ethical questions and the philosophical questions that we have. It's called AlphaGo, actually, the movie. And it's a movie, it's a documentary that was just released, I think it was in January. And it's about that whole entire process of the Google AlphaGo team putting this together, and then the actual competition with the AlphaGo champion, right, who was, this was in South Korea. Right, yep. And so it was very much a documentary full of drama and everything. An amazing thing about this, and this is why I will tell you, I almost cried watching this movie, and it made me feel such empathy for us in general, because the AlphaGo champion was simply, I think he was about 30 years old.
His name is Lee Sedol.
Lee Sedol, thank you very much. And he's 30-something years old, young guy, but considered a legend. You know, globally, he is worshipped in the AlphaGo community. And when the documentarians interviewed him in the beginning, he was very cocky. He's like, yeah, I've got this. It's just a computer. I know what the computer can do. I know. And when he, I got this. But anyway, and the AlphaGo team, mind you, they were very much, they were confident, they weren't as cocky, but they felt like, we are impressed with what we've created, and we think we'll do pretty well. We think AlphaGo will do well. Well, there were five games total, right? And the first game, he lost, meaning the Lee Sedol, he lost. And to see a man whose entire life was based on winning a game that he had just mastered. I mean, he mastered this game. To see this man's entire world crumble from one game
where he was destroyed. When I say destroyed, destroyed by this AI. That to the point where the camera zoomed in on him and he was trying to figure out, what the hell is this thing doing? I will say this. The fascinating thing about this is that he said himself in this movie that he began to understand not just how the game was playing him better, but how he had been playing it very narrowly all his life. And that's when he began to see that this moment was about him allowing himself to be taught by the AI, not just allowing himself to be beat by it, right? So anyway, it was a turning point. So what I would say is regards to that and the ethical questions and everything, by the end of the movie, he came full circle. It's like a typical movie, but he realized that this is a powerful thing. And what I've learned since then, and why we're doing an event about it, is because the AlphaGo community has since then decided that they want to begin to learn how to play from AI and not be threatened by it. So they're now learning how human beings tend to play games sort of winner take all. AI does not do that. You can win by this much, and you're just as much of a winner, right? So anyway, see the film. I implore you. It's a powerful movie.
And because I know that CWA has not provided counselors in the hallway after this session, I want to give you a little bright side story, which is Garry Kasparov, one of the world's grandmasters of chess, was beat by Deep Blue years ago. But then after that evolved a whole area called freestyle chess. Mm. And so teams are forming up where you're allowed to use any software you feel like, and it's a mixture of humans and software, and these teams are competing against each other doing really, really interesting things in chess. So I think the symbiotic relationship between artificial intelligences and the wet ones in our heads is super interesting territory. And I think we're going to see a lot of good come out of that, and probably some not so good stuff as well.
So we have about 10 minutes left, and there is an oh-so-bolder question here. And I'm going to ask this question of the group, and then I'm going to give them a few minutes to comment on anything that they wish to say in conclusion. So here's your oh-so-bolder question. What does an ideal world look like after blockchain succeeds? In other words, what will my life look like after the ideal success of blockchain?
That's a great question. Can somebody go after that?
Sure. I think it starts with the assumption that blockchain can be proved to be reliable and non-hackable. So let's start with that premise, because I think there's still some question about it. And something that I've said in some of my other panels, technology itself is neutral. It's the people who use the technology and what their agendas are that make it a good or bad technology. So particularly talking about things like AI, but some of these others as well. So assuming that you can assure yourself that it's secure, that it's got, can't be hacked, and that we've taken out all the wrinkles, I look at it as an opportunity to simplify record keeping, simplify your life, simplify how you do things. I think it has great potential, but I think we do have to have some assurances that it will not be misused and it cannot be misused, and we have to stay alert to, you know, what are the vulnerabilities.
That's a great answer. I think that in general, I think it will, I hope it will free us to have, I think we will have more time to do the things that we enjoy doing, whatever that may be. We become very used to a lot of the inconveniences of life, and we tend to think it's just natural. You know, we go to the doctor's office, and we have to fill out forms, and we have to wait for information to get to us, and then we have to this. I think that a lot of these inconveniences that we think are minor, which really do take up a lot of time, like dealing with doctors and institutions and going to banks and everything, a lot of that is actually, if the manifestation of blockchain happens the way it's supposed to happen, the way they say it's going to happen, I think you'll find yourself having a lot more time and a lot less grievances than we probably even realize. Mm-hmm.
And I have to use the healthcare example as a big one, because that is big. When you think about the fact that the population is getting older, and we all have parents, and we have to take care of them, and we have to take care of our children, and how much time do we spend in doctor's offices and filling out forms? And think about how much time you spend just filling out forms in your life. I mean, that alone is really a significant amount of time.
And the same form.
It's like, I just did this 2 months ago. Can't you call my other doctor? So, yeah, I think it's time, man. I think it's something that we're not looking at when we talk about these technologies. It's just how much time that mm-hmm. we will have. So,
how many of you, we have 5 minutes left. How many of you use auto pay to pay your bills? Mm-hmm. Raise your hand if you use auto pay. More than half, maybe 2/3 of you. Mm-hmm. Do you like it? Auto pay, pretty convenient. Yeah, pretty good. Every now and then there's a screw up, but not too bad. How about auto life? you walk through the world. You walk onto an airliner, and it's like, oh yeah, I know who Jerry is, and he, you know, the ticket gets paid for behind the scenes. Da da da. What about auto life? It's a possibility, you know. I think the big issue here, if you were asking for an ideal future, I think the big issue is about privacy. Mm. And one of the interesting things about blockchain is that it's a distributed technology that could be a lot more private, not necessarily. The way it's currently architected. Mm-hmm. But if we can conquer some of the privacy issues and the issues about who owns my data and who gets rights to use it and how that works, my friend of mine runs the Internet Identity Workshops, which happen twice a year in Mountain View. And a whole lot of companies are showing up. They're developing products around identity, personal data storage, all kinds of interesting things like that, payment systems, all that. So if we can lick that problem, I think that there's a nice path ahead towards some kind of idealized, more... it's funny, we talk about seamlessness, like mm-hmm. something should be seamless. Years ago, a friend of mine said, you don't want seamless, you want seam full. Because you want the seams to be available so that you can swap out some other service, but that it's elegant, right? So sort of a seam full environment we can walk through that's very convenient.
And to that, which is a great point, I would add the question that I always have our community ask, and that I ask myself with regards to these technologies, and talking about privacy, is when we look at this, the ideal lives that we want or hope for through these technologies, at what cost? That's the question. So if the cost is your data, be prepared to give it up and be okay with that. But ask yourselves this. If we're getting these conveniences and we're getting more time to do the things that we love, at what cost? You know? So if it's data, then data. If it's privacy, I don't know.
Well, that's great. I'm wondering, we've really covered the questions very well, and we're just about out of time. Do you have any concluding comments?
No, thank you.
Well, I want to welcome everybody to the future and hope blockchain is a positive impact on your lives.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much.